From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jamal Joseph's story is unlike many taught in schools during Black History Month. His long list of identifiers includes orphan, activist, FBI fugitive, convict, drug addict, urban guerrilla, and Black Panther. In a speech he made in the 1960s, Jamal urged students to burn down Columbia University. He's now a professor there, and a writer, filmmaker, Oscar nominee, youth advocate, drug counselor, and husband and father. His remarkable story of rebellion and reinvention comes to life in a new book called Panther Baby. The book is out today from Algonquin. Jamal Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I didn't hit on all the credits listed on your book jacket. Is there anything you haven't done, Jamal?
No, I'm not a very good cook, but no, let me correct that. From the Black Panther Party breakfast program, I do make great pancakes.
So you're even more well-rounded than we suspect.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you write about your early life, living with your foster parents / grandparents, Noonie and Pa, Baltimore and the Bronx. You're a studious kid, a church boy. So what was the draw of the Black Panthers for you?
Well, Noonie and Pa had... they were my adopted grandparents, and they took me in when they were quite old, which meant that they had been born in the previous century, in the 19th century. Their parents had been slaves. So I heard about slavery, lynching, firsthand from them. They talked about a South where a black person could not look a white person in the eye, where you had to get off the sidewalk if white people were coming down the sidewalk, lynching of relatives and of friends. They were active from Garvey's Back to Africa movement to the Civil Rights movement. So I grew up with this sense of social consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then joined the NAACP Youth Council when I was 13 years old. When I was 15 and Dr. King was killed, I was radicalized, I was angry, and I wanted to join a militant organization, even though I wasn't quite sure what the term militant really meant, and sought out the Black Panther Party.
And you write in the book, and here I was, an orphan boy, a church boy, and an honor student with an M16 on my lap, pursuing the path to manhood. Tell us a little bit about that path for you. You know, what did you think it was, if it wasn't radicalization or armed insurrection? What was the Black Panther Party for you?
Well, the path to manhood speaks to not knowing my dad. I'd never met my father. Found out much later that he had actually fought alongside Fidel and Che in Cuba. And Pa Baltimore died when I was 12 years old. There's a thing in poor communities, in the black communities, about the men on the corner who have swagger, who are bad, that manhood. So the Panthers had swagger. And they stood up to the system, which is all that we knew. And we knew that we were mad at white people because Dr. King was killed. So we walked into the Panther office, myself and two older friends. We thought that we were joining an organization with plenty of swagger and that they would arm us to go out and avenge Dr. King. So I jumped up in the meeting and I said, "Choose me, brother, arm me. I'll kill a white dude right now." Yeah. And I was called up front, and the information lieutenant who was running the meeting, talking about the Panther 10-point program, by the way, and there's nothing in there about killing white people or going into the streets in that way. And he reached in, and I thought he was giving me a gun, and he gave me a stack of books. I said, "I thought you were going to arm me." He said, "I just did." And he said, "And by the way, if the cops, the racist cops that are beating people up, if they were all black and the people getting beat up were white, people getting shot, if the storekeepers that are ripping off the community, if they were white, if they were black and the people being ripped off were white, and the people in control of this oppressive government, if they were all black and the people being oppressed were white, would that make things correct? Would you feel better?" And I said, "No, it would still seem wrong." He said, "That's right. This is about class struggle and human rights. Study those books so you understand what the revolution is about." So I kind of was drawn in by the charisma of the Panthers and then became a Panther, you know, fortunately, became a Panther, you know, as a result of the mentorship and what I learned. I say fortunately because kids join gangs these days looking for swagger, looking for family. And there is no one there saying, "This is about being politically aware. This is going to be about community service. This is going to be about the real path to manhood and womanhood and family."
But there was still this, I get the sense in the book of that time. It's very alive that when, you know, armed revolution seemed possible, even inevitable, And weapons training was certainly part of your education. Was armed insurrection the goal?
I think the goal was, you know, if you ask someone now, and I want to say that's the awareness, the coming into awareness, the coming out of confusion into awareness, and trying to figure it out, trying to figure out that awkward, you know, I was an adolescent trying to figure out that awkward transition and that path to manhood. That's the voice that I wanted to write the book from, rather than someone who's a, you know, Columbia professor and looks back and, you know, has all of this insight and hindsight on what was going on. So everything seemed possible. The country, it seemed like everything was possible. We were at an age where the youth was questioning adult culture and the politics of the country in general, and then specifically people were coming together. And the Panthers talked about all power to the people, which meant power to all groups, to black people, to white people, to yellow people, to brown people. And you were in the room at, you know, at demonstrations, at college dorms, with people from students from a Democratic Society and the Young Lords Party and Asian radical groups and American Indian groups. And we were young. Mm-hmm. The average age of someone in the Black Panther Party was 19, 20 years old. Yeah. So we talked about this revolution. We talked about demanding a redistribution of the wealth. We talked about you know, human rights and women's rights and all of those things. And we saw the government being repressive. It was clear it was happening in Vietnam. It was happening on college campuses. We had Mississippi State and Kent State where students were being shot down on college campuses. Forget what was happening in the black community when the police were raiding Panther homes and offices and murdering people like Fred Hampton. We felt that they were this felt that self-defense, which would lead to confrontation, was inevitable because of the government, because of the way that they were proceeding. But if you ask someone who was in the Black Panther Party and who was in the movement, what's the number one thing that it all boiled down to? What were you brainwashed to believe above all other things? And people will say something to the effect, we were taught to have an undying love for the people. We were taught to serve the people. This idea of sacrifice, of service, of being willing to, yes, put your life on the line, but to change, to make society a better place, is what I remember most and what my colleagues who were there remember most about what pushed us and what motivated us.
We're talking with Jamal Joseph. He's got a new book out today called Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. That was one of the profound things for me in the book, that this was about love. This was about love of community. And I think so many white Americans and probably black Americans as well have this very distorted picture about who the Panthers were, largely because, you know, the arrests. In fact, you were arrested in a dragnet of what became Panther 21. This was a famous case, charged for allegedly planning to go to war with the government. You go through a hurtful betrayal, for one thing. You were sentenced to 11 months at Rikers Island as a 16-year-old. Later, served 12 years at what you call Leavenworth University. So what did you take away from this prison experience?
Well, what I found in prison is that a lot of what we talked about in terms of bringing people together came into play of when I was able to unite my fellow prisoners through all things. You know, you might think it would be a hunger strike or some kind of resistance, but theater. I had done along the way some theater, first kind of political agitprop theater, and then took some classes and did some acting and you know, some assisted directing on the outside. And it got out when I got in prison that I had done theater. There are no secrets, right? Figure being in the Panthers and activist people knew, and the guys came over and, you know, challenged me to write a play for Black History Month. Now, Leavenworth was segregated. Guys then, as they do now, stayed in their own sections of the yards and didn't mingle. It's segregated and it's tough. And we're having rehearsal, and some of the leaders of the Mexican gangs came in, mm-hmm. and we thought it was going to be a war. And they stood around. They looked really, really upset. Finally, one of the guys called me over, and this was a black cast I was working with. He says, you know, I don't mean to get into your business essay, but that guy's not feeling his character. Mm. So I rewrote the play, and it became a black and Latino play. The guys from the white court came up, and one of the guys came. His name is Rebel, and he came back to all of his guys, and he was 225 pounds in a black belt and, you know, and you know, pretty racist guy. And he came back down to his crew and he said, did you go up there where the blacks and Mexicans were? And he said, yup. And he said, well, what are they doing? And he said, a play. They said, well, what did you do about it, Reb? He said, well, they give me a part. So we had a multicultural group. We had our own courtyard. And then through the theater of oppression and the theater of liberation, people started writing their own stories, and guys invited each other to the college classes, and we started talking about our differences. And then I came to understood that the weapons of social change could be different. Bobby Seale, the founder of the Panther Party, says it in this way, that when the Panthers started in 66, Panthers patrolled the streets of Oakland with shotguns and law books because those were dynamic weapons of social change. The guns were legal. The law showed that the Panthers understood the right of the community to defend themselves from police brutality and from racist attacks. But Bobby said if they were starting the Panthers today, that Panthers would still be out on the street patrolling, but they'd be carrying video cameras and laptop computers because these are the weapons of social change. So I think the energy of change we're seeing in the Occupy movements, the need for change we're seeing with mass incarceration. I grew up in prison because of my political beliefs, my political involvements. You have young black men growing up in prison because they're poor, because the system locks them up, because we have more people in prisons in this country than any nation in the world. And yet we're cutting education and we're tearing down schools, but we're building state-of-the-art prisons. So that need is there. And that same energy of love and being willing to sacrifice everything so that all people can have a better life is more needed than ever.
Well, now you're a full professor at Columbia School of the Arts Film Program. You've been nominated for an Academy Award for your work on this song, Raise It Up. This was featured in the film August Rush. Now, how does that radical, impatient self, that activist, come across in teaching today?
Well, the work that I do with young people, Impact Repertory Theater, is a grassroots organization that I co-founded with Voza Rivers and with my wife, Joyce Joseph, 14 years ago. And the idea was to get kids into a safe space and let them find voice through theater arts. And there's a leadership training component where we talk about what's going on in the community and in the world so that young people can learn to think critically. And we challenge them to do two things. One thing is that they have to know what college that they're going to, whether they're 17 years old, 18 years old, 11 years old, and claim that, because we often don't claim that in poor communities as something that's absolutely going to happen. And the other is that we get them to claim that they're going to give service. So that work, that teaching, all of that really comes back to arts and education and understanding that a liberated mind is the most loving and powerful force on the planet.
Well, Jamal Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
In the background, we're listening to the Academy Award-nominated song Raise It Up that earned an Oscar nomination for the writer, filmmaker, FBI fugitive, convict, Ivy League professor, husband, father, and playwright, Jamal Joseph. We have more on his book, Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention, including a book trailer and some reviews. You'll find all that at wordofmouthradio.org.